I think it is different because it forces us to think about what it is we really want. What we want is wealth. We want more things, cheaper things, and new things. And we want the comfort and security of knowing we will be able to produce these things far into the future. We don't want one more thing, one cheaper thing, and one new thing. And we don't even necessarily want any things right now. We want the potential to create more, cheaper, and new. Money does none of this. Money is not wealth. Money is a claim on wealth. Money is liquid. It is saleable. It is the maximally efficient way of communicating the relative value of things we really want. But it is only itself valuable because all these other things it helps us value either exist in the first place or could exist, pending our intentional, directed effort to allocate time and energy to bringing them into existence. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And we have got a great read today from Alan Farrington and crew over at Axiom BTC. They are announcing and this is axiombtc.capital, by the way. I mean, if you want to check it out, the link will be in the show notes, obviously, with all of the other goodies. But if you want to check them out or get in contact with them, it is axiombtc.capital. And this piece is all about the fact is that their company, this paper that they have released in the announcement of their venture, and the philosophy that all of this is built on, and the framing that they are trying to do is very simple. And I love it because of its simplicity, but because of how incredibly powerful it is, and largely because of its simplicity, is that the killer app of Bitcoin is the repricing of capital. And in announcing what they are doing and what they are building, Alan has written this incredible paper titled Capital in the 21st Century. And I will leave that as our entire introduction, and we will go ahead and get into it. A quick thank you to The Cold Card and CoinKite, the makers of The Cold Card, for supporting this show and making this available to you guys, as well as making incredible hardware and security devices for Bitcoiners. And then, of course, Fold, the Fold app and the Fold Card for giving me a debit card that gets me sats back on everything in my life, because I love to stack sats. I stack sats with my Fold Card, with my fiat purchases, and I send it to my Cold Card. I do not think that the fact that they rhyme is a coincidence. This was destiny. Check them out. Some free sats, 50,000 free sats actually with Fold, and a 9% discount with the Cold Card is right in the show notes. So definitely just scroll down and check that out. And with that, let's get into today's read. And it's titled Capital in the 21st Century by Alan Farrington. Part 1, The Axiom of Capital. Bitcoin has spurred a renaissance of thought on the question of what is money. Bitcoin is often linked to the Austrian school of economics without much thought as to why, but pondering this question allows for the most thoughtful justification. Money is an emergent order, and understanding its operation depends on appreciating irreducible uncertainty, subjective value, and methodological individualism. Often described as a logical treatment of a subject fundamentally resistant to scientific analysis, the emergence of Bitcoin and its acceptance in the market has many Austrians rightly cackling at a real-world proof of the efficacy of the school. On which note, Mises's monumental The Nature of Money and Credit is essential reading for any Bitcoiner, and Menger's On the Origins of Money might be the single best prose answer to the preceding question. more a Bitcoiner himself than an Austrian, or at the very least, a polymath, Nick Szabo's writing is essential reading not only for Bitcoiners, but for anybody struggling to understand what on earth is going on in the world. Contemporary Austrian economist Rahim Tagisa Degan has indeed credited Szabo's thesis in Shelling Out as a novel contribution to the school. That said, we do not think of Axiom as a money business, and nor does anybody else for that matter. We operate in capital markets, and I have personally found it impossible in the past few months to set up a capital markets business without thinking about the nature of capital. The reader will not be surprised in the least to learn, I believe, there is an intimate connection to money, and hence, that capital on a Bitcoin standard is likely to be every bit as different as money, and possibly more so. Joseph Schumpeter's critique of the nonsense of equilibrium as leaving no space for entrepreneurship is as much about capital as anything else. Without entrepreneurs, there is little to distinguish productive capital from mere assets, animate matter rich with potential from mere inanimate stuff. One of the many lessons of Israel Kirzner's analysis on the conceptual links between competition and entrepreneurship is to force the realization that capital is both heterogeneous and unavoidably the product of human creativity. This heterogeneity is arguably the soundest conceptual grounding, or the best formulated axiom, for a non-circular definition, of liquidity. The perfectly liquid capital is money, which is perfectly homogeneous. Money bears no uncertainty because it is the standard of value against which uncertain endeavors are to be measured. The role of the entrepreneur is to embrace uncertainty by accumulating capital, putting it to heterogeneous use in the creative and competitive pursuit of the satisfaction of the value of others. So far, so simple, and so seemingly axiomatic. But if you are reading this, you are most likely interested in Bitcoin. And if you have been kind enough to invest in Axiom Venture Fund 1, then you most certainly believe that we are still early. And so I put it to the reader that this, or perhaps the consequences of this, is not at all widely understood. There are plenty of definitions of capital out there, but my favorite definition is not at all technical, and is not from an Austrian. It is that of Hernando de Soto. It is not even a definition per se, but more of an image. This is exactly why I like it. In the dismal science, rhetorical flourish is hard to come by, especially while remaining somewhat accurate and without spiraling into statist agitprop. In his fantastic The Mystery of Capital, de Soto calls capital economic potential energy. To my mind, this helpfully emphasizes two things. One, that work has been done, but the fruits of that work have not yet been realized. And two, that they can be realized with intention, with human action. It is within our power, not as Homo economici, but as individual thinking humans, to tap this reserve of potential energy based on what we value. It is not the preserve of the omniscient, omnipotent capital czar who allocates all capital from a palace in the sky. Nor is Hayek obsoleted by advances in artificial intelligence, to cite exactly some such fashionable statist agitprop. It is the entrepreneur that is the motor of the world. She thinks as an individual, she acts in the moment, and she allocates at the margin. Steve Jobs, an entrepreneur if there ever was one, once famously said,
"I think one of the things that really separates us from the high primates is that we're tool builders." And I read a study that measured the efficiency of locomotion for various species on the planet. The condor used the least energy to move a kilometer. And humans came in with a rather unimpressive showing about a third of the way down the list. It was not too proud of a showing for the crown of creation. So that didn't look so good, but then somebody at Scientific American had the insight to test the efficiency of locomotion for a man on a bicycle. And a man on a bicycle, or a human on a bicycle, blew the condor away, completely off the top of the charts. And that's what a computer is to me. What a computer is to me is it's the most remarkable tool that we've ever come up with. And it's the equivalent of a bicycle for our minds.
This is usually understood as commentary on technology, but I think it is more about capital. A less romantic framing, perhaps, than economic potential energy, capital is tools. Jobs' point is about how potent software is as a form of capital. But ultimately, all capital magnifies the desirability of the output of some exertion of time and energy. A bicycle is one example, and a computer is another. At the risk of mixing metaphors, capital is the bicycle of labor, of time, of effort, and of the grind to produce value by hand. Capital is tools. More things, cheaper things, new things. What does money have to do with all this? The non-answer is to say that money is the most liquid form of capital, but that is to subscribe to a circular explanation. If by liquid we simply mean the time and difficulty required to transform something into money, then money can be transformed into money in zero time and with zero difficulty. Hence, it must be maximally liquid. We have both stated and proven a tautology. The fiat economists would be proud. I suggest we attempt to invert this understanding of liquidity. Instead of trying to capture how easily and quickly we can convert capital into money, what if what we meant was how easily and quickly we can convert money into capital? Okay, why? Is this even different, or am I just playing with words? I think it is different because it forces us to think about what it is we really want. What we want is wealth. We want more things, cheaper things, and new things. And we want the comfort and security of knowing we will be able to produce these things far into the future. We don't want one more thing, one cheaper thing, and one new thing. And we don't even necessarily want any things right now. We want the potential to create more, cheaper, and new. Money does none of this. Money is not wealth. Money is a claim on wealth. Money is liquid. It is saleable. It is the maximally efficient way of communicating the relative value of things we really want. But it is only itself valuable because all these other things it helps us value either exist in the first place or else could exist, pending our intentional, directed effort to allocate time and energy to bringing them into existence. Money is neither sufficient nor necessary for wealth, but capital arguably is. Real wealth is illiquid, and the liquidity of money is useful first and foremost because it makes it far easier and more efficient to allocate capital than otherwise. Another way of thinking about all this is that money is time. More specifically, money is time now. But capital is something different. Capital is the cumulative product of having decided not to consume today, but to make more, cheaper, and newer the future ability to consume. Capital is all time ever. I do not believe it is appropriate to propose that people should want only to consume in the future. That is none of my business. But we can approach the same issue more subtly. If you wanted to forego consumption and maximize your potential to later consume, could you? What are your incentives either way? To do our best to minimize the economics jargon once again, we might simply ask, what are you going to do with your time? Are you going to create or consume? And how do the characteristics of money, as the saleable representation of that time, influence your decision? I sincerely believe that this is the killer app for Bitcoin, pricing capital. If there were ever a time to say that Bitcoin fixes this, here it is. Stocks and flows. But is this even broken? Can't we price capital now? We can, but my goodness, is it difficult? If you look at what has happened in capital markets over the last 15 years at least, this will become clearer and clearer. Until very recently, I worked in this world. Indeed, it was the only adult job I ever had besides this one. I enjoyed it greatly and am grateful for having the opportunity to study and learn as I did. In this role, I chipped in here and there teaching the new hires the basics of financial theory. What I dreamed up to teach them, I was pitching at folks who I assumed were extremely intelligent, but who had no experience of economics or finance. I found that an invaluable tool to explore this was by using the concepts of stocks and flows. Below is a cartoon version of a balance sheet and an income statement, in which I attempt to visually convey how the two evolve over time. See next page. In that pedagogical context, I was trying to explain as much from first principles as possible. The difference between returns and what is commonly called, quote, growth, but is really just an, quote, increase. The graphic shows the blocks of capital in a business process and where revenue, costs, and profits fit into it. So we start with the funding in purple, the productive assets in orange, and the cash needed to cover cost of delivering the product. But then the revenue comes in yellow, with a certain amount as profit, in blue. But the important change in the second cycle is that the profits, the blue, are now used for the funding, and this is used in order to increase the amount of productive assets, the orange, which leads to more revenue and more profits, which are then cycled back into more productive assets, etc. You can see this graphic on page 7 of the PDF linked in the description. All this is intended to represent the cycle of capital through a business. You get liquid, homogeneous capital, money, you transform it into illiquid, heterogeneous capital, productive assets, to create a product, keeping a little liquid to cover the cost of delivering the product. And if you profit, that means you get to go again and create even more capital, except that this time you get to fund it yourself. In the context of financial analysis, one of the key implications I intended to communicate with this principle is that the measure of success is not that the yellow number goes up, and it's not even that the dark blue number goes up. It's that the dark blue to purple ratio stays high, because that is the only sustainable way that the orange number can go up, and this is where wealth comes from. Everything else here is valuable only insofar as it lets us do this efficiently. But of course, in the world of quarterly profit and loss finance, nobody cares. They want the yellow number to go up at all costs, which might be a good thing, but it might not. And in particular, they want the ratio of successive yellow numbers to go up. They call this ratio growth, even though it is really an increase. It is a dimensionless ratio of one flow to another. A real growth rate has the dimensions of 1 over time, like the ratio of profit over a period to its funding at the start of that period, or dark blue to purple above. The reader can hopefully see that what this ratio captures is the real, causal, time-dependent process by which the ability to produce grows. This misunderstanding that we should care about short-term flows rather than long-term rates of return on stocks, I would say is basically the original sin of fiat finance and fiat economics. It is how you get the idea that, quote, we need to stimulate the economy. It's why you might think there is nothing wrong with gutting manufacturing capabilities and energy infrastructure because services are higher margin and, quote, scale better. It's how you end up foaming at the mouth over quarterly earnings, as if any meaningful investment project could take 3 months, and as if the measure of its success would be a flow and not a stock. It's also how you get the idea that trading JPEGs is productive, or that the product of capital accumulation should be artificial scarcity rather than abundance, not more and cheaper, but capped and expensive. It's how you think that if you create a simulacrum of wealth at no cost, real wealth can somehow follow, just because you have bootstrapped an idea. Not productive capacity, not the potential to create more, cheaper, and new, but claims on wealth that you cross your fingers somebody else will actually work to create. And it's how you end up with one of the greatest misallocations of capital in the history of venture capital, and possibly in the history of capital markets. Real capital is scarce, precious even. It is, after all, accumulated time. If it is going towards something stupid and short-termist, then it isn't going towards anything intelligent and long-termist. If the money we use to decide how to allocate capital does not reflect this scarcity, we will think there is no cost to short-termism. The incentive here is not wealth, it's just profit. It's not a stock, it's just a flow. It is not to create tools, it's just to dismantle them and trade the parts for fun. The point of profit. The reader might wonder if there is anything really wrong with that. Am I revealing a paternalistic pedantry of no clear relation to economics? Greed is good, right? What is the point of investing in the first place if it is not to profit? Isn't profit a marker, nay, the marker, of entrepreneurial success and sustainable economic contribution? As a final tease, I would put forward that a far better contentious proverb to employ here than Gordon Gekko's motto would be from the Old Testament of the King James Bible, in which we are counseled that the love of money is the root of all evil. Unfortunately, this is commonly misquoted as money is the root of all evil, which does a dire disservice to the message. The two could hardly be more different. It would be a little odd for the general partner of a Bitcoin-focused financial services firm to believe that money is the root of all evil, and yet I have a great deal of sympathy for 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 10. I think it can even be a potent tool to distinguish not the technology, but the cultures of Bitcoin and crypto, and Bitcoin and fiat. I believe it is completely backwards to think that the point of investing is profit. The point of profit is investing. Money means nothing without the capital and the products of capital that it prices. We like to think it means our time, which is true to an extent, but our time is not valuable in the slightest without the stocks of capital that multiply its productivity. Profit means nothing beyond the means to continue compounding capital in a truly independent manner. There is capital employed without profit, but there is no profit without capital employed. Moreover, profit is the informational signal that the way you are creating capital is valued by others. Profits are great, but returns are better. To ground this more in everyday experience, if you knew your money was going to be more valuable in the future, how would you invest? The logical approach would be to invest such that your return, while still compounding in value, would come as late as possible. You want your return as far in the future as it can be, partly because the later it comes, the more value it will have compounded, but partly also because that is more efficient than constantly having to think of new projects, developing new skills, testing new markets, and so on. This means that at a personal level, you're incentivized to develop skills as specific as possible, crystallize the value of these skills by creating capital as heterogeneous and illiquid as possible, and spend as much time as possible thinking about deepening these skills and crystallizing this value. But what if your money was going to be less valuable in the future? Well, all of that would be flipped. You would want your return as soon as possible, and you'd want the optionality of new projects and new markets, which means you are incentivized to develop skills as general as possible and hold capital as liquid and homogeneous as possible. This would mean you are incentivized to stay on top of everything happening in the immediate term, to trade around it, and to spend little time or no time focusing on the long term. Any wealth you do own, or that you can create, you really ought to financialize to increase its liquidity. Better yet, you ought to financialize somebody else's wealth. Even better still, you ought to leverage somebody else's financialized wealth. Force others to leverage to compete, misallocate more capital, or even start to consume it. Create more money and ensure everybody's money will be less valuable in the future so we can start this merry-go-round all over again. In the latter, as long as you profit, everything is fine. In fact, if you have sufficient capability to financialize, you don't even need profit now. You can promise endless future profits. Grow, i.e., quote, increase. Sell the rights to them and move on. Everything becomes reducible to its immediate flows. But as you gradually strip away your own and everyone else's capital, as you dismantle, trade, and consume every tool, you will find returns to be more and more elusive, and eventually impossible. The only important question becomes, who is holding the bag? Bitcoin fixes this. Bitcoin forces us to think first and foremost about the stock. It enables us to think far more clearly than we would otherwise about the potential to create more things, cheaper things, and new things. This is no mere thought experiment. It is happening around us at a bewilderingly accelerated rate. It's happening in mining, in the Lightning Network, in Nostr right now, and in the long run, we wouldn't dare be so arrogant as to suggest what opportunities can be known. Properly incentivized, purposeful, acting humans are nothing if not creative, and Bitcoin is nothing if not an inducement to create. Bitcoin's killer app. Whilst it is technically correct to say Bitcoin mining secures the network, I find this explanation to be dry. We might channel my earlier articulated appreciation of DeSoto and observe there is a difference between a definition that is technically accurate and one that is rhetorically effective. The hash rate, after all, is a flow. I would argue a more imaginative conception of the global network of Bitcoin miners is as a distributed network of capital, a stock and a tool that earns a return which is contingent on energy efficiency, and so which incentivizes more energy, cheaper energy, and new energy. More energy because Bitcoin pays for waste and for load balancing. This creates extra profit, not to be cackled over by fat cat executives, but to be reinvested in heterogeneous capital to utilize yet more wasted energy and increase productive output. Cheaper energy because this reinvestment will enable efficiency gains, supplementing the returns of energy infrastructure, and will in turn lead to deflation as it is absorbed by the market. And new energy because Bitcoin makes it possible to exploit stranded resources with only an internet connection instead of costly transmission infrastructure. The Lightning Network may be explained in equally dry terms of solving Bitcoin scalability. And once again, this is not incorrect, but neither is it exciting. It is once again affirming that this has a technical purpose and is more than just a toy. But it is a purpose that focuses on flows rather than stocks. Instead, we might consider it a distributed network of heterogeneous capital allocation that generates a return contingent on enabling payment efficiency. The consequence is more payments, cheaper payments, and new payments. More payments because fiat payment rails have counterparty risk, jurisdictional firewalls, and lower bounds on economically rational, transferable value, all of which are absent in the Lightning Network. Cheaper payments because the network is robust, anti-fragile, and decentralized, and every node operates as a kind of cellularly autonomous market maker in liquidity, meaning routing is competitive and gross costs are driven down, as opposed to the network as a whole seeking to profit maximize by holding costs up. And new payments, because all of this enables such innovations as, quote, payment streaming, very small payments at very short intervals so as to proxy a continuous flow, and programmable exchange, APIs for exchanging proprietary computational resources directly for bearer value in an automated manner rather than at the manual behest of a human. Nostr has often been characterized as a Twitter alternative. This is accurate enough in terms of the first use case to gain any major traction, but it is woefully unimaginative in terms of how widely Nostr could come to be utilized. Instead, we might consider it a distributed means of harnessing the Lightning Network to align the subjective economic valuation of data with the physical cost of the infrastructure facilitating its broadcast. The consequence is more communications, cheaper communications, and new communications. More communications because the user experience of traditional online communications networks is subject to the design considerations of their operators. Whereas the free and open source nature of the Nostr protocol is such that anybody can build a client or integrate the protocol into an app to create whatever experience they want. Cheaper communications, because via Lightning, the signal of value is directly and bidirectionally expressed in the act of communicating between sender, router, and receiver. Building services on Nostr is significantly cheaper than any prior alternative because the network is open and can be tapped into without first building a network effect and its supporting infrastructure from scratch. And from the user's perspective, while legacy social networks are superficially, quote, free, the adage of if the service is free, the product is you, is healthily absent in Nostr, enabling the ability to be paid for valuable contribution as well as to pay for what is valued in a disintermediated fashion. And new communications, because Nostr doesn't rely on any centralized entity capable of shutting down politically inconvenient content. Let us contrast these heterogeneous, illiquid tools to what we have become used to under fiat. We get worse things and more expensive things, and although it is true that we get more things, one has to wonder what kind of thing such an intense pressure to consume drives us to produce more of. I am not convinced it is worth it. If the source of more is pulling forward value from the future that we have no intention of repaying, and allocating time towards this activity and away from experiments in the realm of the cheaper and the new, then it is not something I am inclined to celebrate. If the value we believe we have concocted is merely a securitization that makes more liquid a representation of the illiquid, but does not make anything illiquid, it is not something I am inclined to support. The farmer can always boost consumption by eating seed rather than by planting it, or by selling that which he has not yet produced. One can always consume more if one is willing to consume capital, but I'd rather we create it. This is what we would expect to flourish from real capital accumulation: the potential for more things, cheaper things, and newer things that we can rely on if needed, but which we don't need to consume. Of course, we still have scarce time with which to decide what kind of capital to create, and so the price of capital is critically important as well. I believe that the price of capital is Bitcoin's killer app. Bitcoin fixes this. I think there is a plausible argument that this is axiomatically true. Capital is the weave in the fabric of economic life. If Bitcoin fixes capital, then Bitcoin truly does fix everything. Is this our axiom? For all X, Bitcoin fixes X? Is this the mystery of capital? Sure, but we can go further still. Bitcoin is not an end, but a means. Like all capital, it is a tool to serve humans and to enable human flourishing. Above even its effect on capital, we must hold at the front of our minds its effect on people. A tool does not wield itself, nor does a business spontaneously emerge. A skilled technician wields a tool, and an entrepreneur builds a business. To echo Kirzner, this is a perfectly competitive market. All it takes is an idea and the will to pursue it. Brains and guts. And so we can echo DeSoto once more as well. Jettison technical jargon one final time, and end on a rhetorical flourish. We can trim our axiom even further and ask more simply, is Bitcoin not for all? Yes, it is. All we need now are the tools to get there. Let's create them. Alan Farrington, July 2023. This show is brought to you by CoinKite, the makers of the Cold Card. The Cold Card is a highly versatile, highly secure, and one of the longest running hardware wallets in the Bitcoin space. It is a super popular wallet. It is loved by the most cypherpunk of Bitcoiners. And if you want to own Bitcoin, if you want to know that it is behind your keys, the Cold Card is your answer. And the number of other features and the optionality and the means of connecting. Like I know everybody, I say it all the time, but NFC, the ability to do just tap to pay with a wallet like Nunchuck and to do that in multi-sig is so cool that you genuinely have to experience it in order to understand. Your keys are never on the phone, and all you have to do is tap your cold card to it and hit sign. This is an insane level of security at an affordable price. You know, this is something that I think Bitcoiners really discount, that the amount of security and the devices and the features that they have, the security and privacy features that they have access to, used to be an insanely rare thing and would cost incredible amounts of money. And now Bitcoiners get it for an incredibly affordable amount of money, or they even get it for free with many of the protocols and the apps and the things that are available in this space. And CoinKite has been a huge part of that. They have been doing this since 2011. And if you haven't gotten yourself a hardware wallet, you need to go to bitcoinaudible.com/coinkite. And do not forget, you can get 9% off the cold card with code BitcoinAudible. The link and the code will be right there in the show notes. My favorite thing about this article or this paper, not only are they announcing Axiom BTC and the effort or the framing that they are taking with their deployment of capital and the way that they're thinking about investment, but just the simple reality of repricing things in Bitcoin, and that we have not really made a strong effort to do that. We've just kind of played this, it's worth X amount of dollars game, when that's the whole point. That is the whole point of being here. And that is the whole thing. That is the very thing that Bitcoin is set to solve. You know, when we understand that fiat amplifies all of these negative things, that this huge misallocation of resources leads to investing in unsustainable projects that have a nominal return that are actually a destruction of resources. And so it leads to more and more wasteful endeavors, that it makes the toxic bigness of corporations ever worse because the inflated price of their stock and the availability of capital towards those institutions is circular. If they get more financing because they're big, they're more likely to be invested in by everybody's retirements, because nobody can just stick money under a mattress, because money bleeds. Money dies if you just leave it somewhere. You can't save for the future. So what do you have to do? You have to invest in stocks. But nobody's a stock investor. Everybody's completely ignorant. They don't know what the hell they're doing. So what happens? It gets put into an index fund that just pushes it all into a bunch of big corporations that are big because they're big and they get more money. So they actually beat inflation. And because they beat inflation, which is circular for a purely circular reason, well, then they're the ones that get the new financing, because now you don't have to think about financing anymore. You just give it to somebody big with a stock on the stock market that's in an index, and they're going to go up over time. So this inflates these huge corporate environments that are not even sustainable, and they're not agile. They can't even change. It bloats and corrupts the genuine economics or the genuine dynamics of the economies of scale, and it makes them unsustainable, and it promotes bigness over agility and actual entrepreneur activity, like genuine innovation. And then what happens when you can just keep funding them and keep giving them more financing at lower and lower rates that are all just mispriced loans? Well, what happens is that they run out of the ability to innovate, and they cannot actually switch gears fast enough. So instead of actually doing innovation, what they do is they just buy up small competitors, because they can get the financing when the small competitors can't. Startups can't get financing. Nobody wants to invest in that. Nobody wants to invest in rebuilding infrastructure or actually making huge, significant changes and taking large risks. What they want is to invest in a hypey-sounding idea that's just good enough that they can put some money in it, and then they can turn around and sell it to some giant corporation. And this is all incentivized by the fiat apparatus, by the system of money printing and debt creation. And what does this lead to? This leads to more frivolous expenditures. This leads to a cheap and thoughtless culture of VC that's trying so hard to get as many flows as possible to just turn that money around with a profit as quick as possible, and they don't care about stocks. It completely negates. Everybody chases the number. Everybody chases the nominal return rather than thinking about the actual capital that they are investing in and what its long-term purpose is. And it destroys the value of blue-collar work in the economy, the things that actually keep shit running. And it bloats this giant administrative managerial class that doesn't even need to be there. It's just supervisors for supervisors, and the workers just become peons. They need all of their ability to even make decisions or to make valuations and judgments in the position that they are in is pushed up into the managerial class, and they are necessarily disconnected from the situation. So you have more and more people further and further removed from the actual situation making the decisions. And so the people just become dumb. They just become like dependent and subservient, and they're afraid to make decisions. They don't want to do anything without permission. They have to beg for permission to do simple things. It literally makes them like sheep. And then they're so absolved of any responsibility for anything, they take the same thing in their culture and their life, and they spread it around, and they spread it to the next generation. And all of these things cycle back on each other. Every single time it gets worse in one area, it pushes the same behavior, the same effects, and the same thought processes into everything adjacent to it. And then that financing cycle, it reinforces it into the new space, because every single time you find out you can take advantage of this, it reinforces that behavior, and then it goes another round. It keeps cycling over and over and over again and getting worse and worse until the culture is completely degraded. The financial sector has nothing to do with actually building capital. It's just nothing but gambling and corruption, and it leads to all of these things getting worse and to fail to realize. It's amazing how nihilistic we are. Even like, I even talk to people, even in Bitcoin sometimes, that drive me crazy, that they're like, no, this is just how it works. Everybody's going to be corrupt. There's nothing you can do. If you build real capital, it's never going to be meaningful. And the corrupt and the evil are just going to make all the money. But the fundamental structure incentivizes this. And if you fix the fundamental structure, everything being shitty isn't the natural way of the world. It just isn't. And it's crazy that we have been led to believe that we have no power, that we have no option, there's no way to fix anything. And it's like, of course nothing's ever going to get fixed if that's what you think. It's a prerequisite to doing anything that you actually believe it's meaningful, that would actually accomplish something. I mean, who would take on a lifelong, decades-long project and invest all of this capital and try to accomplish this thing if literally you just believed that there was never going to be any positive result from it, that you could never actually accomplish anything with that task? Nobody would take on that task. Nobody would do that for 20 minutes if they just knew at the end, if they would convince themselves that at the end of that 20 minutes, they were going to have worked really hard and nothing would have come of it. Believing that we can fix things comes first. It comes before actually being able to fix anything, because it requires capital. It requires investment. It requires us to take our time and our labor and our emotional investment into seeing something through. That's one of the biggest hurdles, is just getting over the hump of believing that we can do something about this. And it seems crazy to me that it's so difficult, even for people who understand how bad the fiat apparatus is and how bad the fiat system is at incentivizing frivolous gambling and bloating a financial system so that it's corrupt and has nothing to do with capital, to misallocate trillions and trillions of dollars into investments that make no sense and are doing nothing good for anyone and are unsustainable to boot, that it causes a huge misallocation of resources towards the wealthy, the already wealthy. It creates a ever-largening gap between the rich and the poor, that it guts the middle class, that it guts the manufacturing, it guts the genuine capital productivity of the economy, and it dismantles the tools. I loved that line about dismantling and selling off your tools in order to get a greater nominal gain, to chase the GDP, to chase the pseudoscience of economic statistics. Got to get those consumption numbers up. It doesn't matter that consumption is actually a consequence of production, and that it is investing in production that actually leads to higher consumption. No, we're just going to believe that consumption is good for the sake of consumption. We're going to destroy things and we're going to eat the seed for next year's harvest because that means that we're wealthy. Which is exactly like saying if you give everybody in the country a house, then that means everybody will be middle class, while failing to realize it's putting the cart before the horse. It's believing that the result is the indication of the input. The output is equivalent to the input. And so if you just artificially create the output everywhere, we create a high GDP, we push everybody into houses, we create loans so that everybody can afford X, and the price of X goes up by 600-700%, but that's no big deal because we can just push more loans and we can push interest rates even further. Now everybody is economically sustainable. Now everybody is responsible. And they have good investment decisions, and they've built themselves a sustainable life, and they have a family, and all of these things that the middle class actually have to do in order to achieve that end. If we just shove them into the end, we just shove them into the results we hope that they would achieve, all of the prerequisites, all of the mindset, all of the decision making, all of the difficult choices of which skill to acquire and which to not, those have just already occurred. But I'm going to go back to the comment about the dismantling the tools, because I really just love this section, because it's such a good succinct breakdown of what the fiat system pushes into the individual mindset. Like, what happens when money loses value? So I'll read this section. It says, but what if your money was going to be less valuable in the future? Well, all of that would be flipped. You would want your return as soon as possible, and you'd want the optionality of new projects and new markets, which means you're incentivized to develop skills as general as possible and hold capital as liquid and homogeneous as possible. This would mean you're incentivized to stay on top of everything happening in the immediate term, to trade around it, and to spend little time or no time focusing on the long term. Any wealth you do own or that you can create, you really ought to financialize to increase its liquidity. I'm going to interject right here. This is exactly why crypto is fiat. Why crypto is just an extension of fiat, is that we're going to financialize everything. Everything is going to have a token. When the whole point of money is to be the universal record of any other value that you can achieve or any other utility you hope to achieve, because it's the ultimate language of communicating and valuing all those things. The idea of having a token for everything, a token for this network and a token for bananas and a token for dentistry and a token for smart contracts and a token for privacy. Like, it's completely nonsensical because we already are trying to price those things to have an illiquid token that is trying to create more liquidity. You're trying to homogenize all of these disparate specialities and these different utilities and these different use cases. It's like saying that, it's very difficult to price a car in bananas because they have nothing to do with each other. It's also really hard to price bananas in cars. Like, how many bananas is a car worth? 50,000 bananas? Who knows? They have completely different processes. They're from different corners of the earth. None of the workers are the same. One of them is grown. It's a form of farming, and it's plants in, trees in South America, whatever it is. Like, they have nothing to do with each other. The attempt of trying to weigh one in the other. A car lasts 40 years. A banana lasts 3 days. The idea of fiat, or the fiat idea of, like, well, let's make it liquid, let's financialize the bananas and then sell the tokens. And the idea of crypto is that we're going to tokenize the car and we're going to tokenize the bananas, and then you're going to be able to trade, you're going to be able to speculate on the difference between these two things and what the price is. And we're going to have bananas priced in cars, and we're going to have cars priced in bananas in this insanely tiny illiquid market where everybody is just gambling, everybody's just speculating, and there's this huge friction between actually communicating the value of these two things because they're illiquid, and because you literally have to have a market of people who give a shit about bananas and cars right at this instant for your pricing mechanism to be of use in any way whatsoever, which means you're just going to have crazy wild swings, and you have this huge market of people just gambling for no reason. Speculating on tokens is wasting thousands or tens of thousands of man hours and stress and people who are actually smart and could learn a skill and could grow bananas or make cars instead sit in front of a computer screen and do pseudoscience technical analysis trying to decide whether cars are going to go up in relation to bananas today or vice versa. And then they're paying fees to rent seekers 100 different times a day, all to try to figure out a pricing mechanism and two bullshit tokens that have no other purpose. It's like trying to have an individual language for every single thing that you do. You have a language when you want to code. You have a language when you want to cut your lawn. You have to speak a different language with your lawnmower guy. You have to speak a different language when you're building a house. You have to speak a different language when you want to go buy bananas from the store. It's just stupid. It's stupid. It is this financialization of everything. And I didn't even finish my quote. So, quote, let's go back. So, quote, any wealth that you do own or that you can create, you really ought to financialize to increase its liquidity. Better yet, you ought to financialize somebody else's wealth. Even better still, you ought to leverage somebody else's financialized wealth. Force others to leverage to compete, misallocate more capital, or even start to consume it. Create more money and ensure everybody's money will be less valuable in the future so we can start this merry-go-round all over again. In the latter, as long as you profit, everything is fine. In fact, if you have sufficient capability to financialize, you don't even need profit now. You can promise endless future profits. You can grow, quote unquote, or increase, sell the rights to them, and move on. Everything becomes reducible to its immediate flows. But as you gradually strip away your own and everybody else's capital, as you dismantle, trade, and consume every tool, you will find returns to be more and more elusive and eventually impossible. The only important question becomes, who is holding the bag? If your returns, if your nominal gains are by financializing and leveraging the capital you already have, and then when that is run dry, you begin to dismantle the capital and sell it to get a nominal return because you have no reason, you have no incentive, you have no economic signal. The money is telling you nothing about the fact that your capital is being depleted. It literally runs until you run out of capital. And then all of your stock, all of the capital that makes any of the financialization make any sense whatsoever, it's just there to reallocate and to determine ownership of stuff that exists. The tokens are meaningless. A banana token isn't worth shit without a banana. The same is true for every stock, for every ETF, for everything. The tokens are just representations. The word love doesn't mean anything if there's nobody to love. Money is an allocator, and when it fails to send the signals of the most important parts of building and allocating resources, society literally eats itself until it's dead. And it takes decades and decades to actually replenish shit. We're dismantling centuries worth of infrastructure that we've built up. We're misallocating entire cities, like whole civilizations worth of capital and wealth is being squandered and eaten. We're literally a society of cannibals because money is telling us that if we just eat our own leg, everything will be better. And for all the shit about network utilities and privacy and lightning and all that great stuff, Bitcoin's killer app is fixing that shit. And what's crazy is how simple the mental perspective is, the framing of it is that, okay, if we're going to build a project, if we're going to invest in something, if we're going to build out infrastructure, price it in Bitcoin today and isn't going to make a return in Bitcoin in a year, in 10 years, price it in Bitcoin to make it worthwhile. And what happens? The most pressing and valuable concerns get met first. And then we work our way down the line and we can actually plan for the long term. And a great example actually was a tweet that happened this morning when I was coming back to finish up this guy's take. And I'm glad I actually left a little bit to come back to. So I wanted to sit on this article for a few days. I've read this or finished this up, I don't know, sometime this week. But Joe Burnett had a really cool chart of the median household price in sats. And so I'll read this tweet real quick. It says, spending over a billion sats on a new house will likely be a poor investment. Less than 5 years ago, new houses were going for about 5 billion sats. An 80% decline is not something you should strive for. And he's got this chart of the United States median new house in priced in sats. And in 2019, it peaked at about 7.5 billion, maybe about 8 billion actually. And then it has been declining. It's been, you know, a bumpy road. And it went down to, it's now 1.4 billion sats is the median house price. And anybody who has been measuring that in fiat has been making a grave mistake. They've been thinking that that is a worthwhile investment. If you're buying a house, like when I purchased and like I'm investing in my house, I'm not doing it as an investment decision, or at least I'm not expecting profit. I'm doing it because it's important long-term infrastructure. It's our home. It's for my family. I know I am spending Bitcoin that I will not get back from this quote unquote investment. I'm not trying to do that. That's why I know it is worthwhile, because I am losing Bitcoin to continue investing in our life and my family and the things that we actually want to sustain our lives. And we're not making huge investments. We don't have a big house. We have a very small house. We have a very humble little life. But it is worthwhile to spend on that life, knowing that I will lose the Bitcoin, knowing that we will not get it back, because we actually have a Bitcoin pricing weight. We know that it is a loss of capital. And therefore, I know I'm not going to regret the decision later, because I did not falsely believe that this was going to be a profitable investment. It was never made under that context. Why? Because I price it in Bitcoin. The fact that my house might be worth $1 million in the not too distant future because the dollar will be worth shit won't mean anything to me, because I'll know what it costs in Bitcoin. I'll know I won't be able to get it back because Bitcoin will be $1 million too. If you do not have accurate pricing, if you are not using an economic signaling mechanism that tells you anything genuinely true about the economic network that you are taking part in, about the actual value of the capital that you are investing in, how do you intend to invest properly in capital? It literally is a prerequisite. We can't just know these things. This is fundamentally unknowable information. It's crucial that you actually have the response, the feedback mechanism of the pricing system in order to actually understand the value of these decisions. And one of the things that he points out in this, that Axiom paper, or the Capital in the 21st Century, points out, that I thought was really, really great, that I hadn't really considered. It's not that I hadn't considered it. It's that it hadn't been a focus. And it's one of those things that when pointed out, you're like, I know I've heard this somewhere, and I know I've, you know, we've talked about it in the past, but it's just easy to let some of those things slip away. Is the fact that the communication mechanism of money, when money is actually communicating long-term value and it is allowing you to weigh your goods and services against others, and you actually have a valuable piece of the economic network that you can actually withdraw your resources, the resources that you put in, you can withdraw them later, and you're able to see the actual production's not the word, the feedback of the value of the network over time reflected in the deflationary, the higher purchasing power of your money, that it actually makes you make sustainable decisions. It means that you're actually responding to economic reality, or at least as judged in a massively parallel supercomputer run by hundreds of millions, billions of people, right? All of their individual voluntary decisions and their relationships to their past and the decisions that they made and the money that went into it. Because you are actually responding to that feedback mechanism, and you have that level of certainty in a mechanism, or as a system of increasing uncertainty, of increasing complexity and increasing diversity and specialization, it allows you to specialize. It is what allows the trade to actually occur. It's why you can solely invest in learning how to, I don't know, make a podcast or read or invest specifically in infrastructure projects, in learning how to just learning how to code and not needing to know how to grow your food. It might be beneficial to have some of that knowledge to understand how these things work, but you don't have to literally go out and learn how to grow food in order to eat, because you can rely on the economic network. You can rely on others in order to specialize in that job, and because the economic communication mechanism, the money that you use, is actually accurate, it actually has a genuine feedback mechanism, well, you can diminish some of that uncertainty by knowing that you're part of a robust economic network. But when the economic network is lying to you, when it breaks down, it means that you specialize less and less. What you just want to have, like, this big capital becomes homogenized. You want to financialize everything. Everything is going to become a token. And it makes sense to go more and more general, to focus more and more on flows, on just having just enough knowledge to be able to invest or have some sort of a turnover or have some sort of a quick flow in anything that you do, and to shift gears quickly between which flow is most maximum at any particular moment. That's why you have bubbles. And why you can't predict quite where any of it will be at any one time, because this is, again, going back to the idea of a self-referential loop, is that when money is chasing one thing or one potential flow, well, then the more of the new money is directed toward that, because it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. The more new money, if you counterfeit money and you put it into X investment is going to go up, which means that all of the new counterfeit money is not going to go to A through W or Y or Z, it's literally all going to go to X now. And it doesn't even matter that A through G is literally keeping society alive. Well, they just become culturally irrelevant. And the fact that we need them is just kind of like brushed off, because look at the people who are all making money on X. Clearly, X is the most valuable and important thing that can happen and that we can build on in society today. So what do you get? You get millions and millions of houses built that nobody even needs, and that the rich are just investing in so they can park money, because money is just depleting in value. And it's depleting in value faster in relation to houses than it is, you know, use case A through W. And so that's where all the new money goes. And so the illusion that this is the best place to put money just gets worse and worse. It just gets worse and worse. And it's all a lie. It is all fake. It is all bullshit, manipulation by the money printer, and whatever name they give their money printing in this phase of the shitstorm of just depleting all of our capital and cannibalizing society. But if you correct that, if you just stop pricing shit in fiat, in something that can be printed, decision-making actually has a foundation to work off of again, one that is relevant to the economic network. The killer app of Bitcoin is repricing capital. So let's do that. Anyway, that should do it. A huge thank you to Alan Farrington, to Axiom BTC, not only for this piece, but also for reaching out to me to do the audio. And because, I mean, if anybody's listened to me read any of Alan and Sasha and Bitcoin is Venice and any of the things that the Capital Strip Mine, this is not capital. I mean, the number of works that I have read and I have always enjoyed, just fun, great pieces. It always gets me worked up. It always gets me on some ridiculous rant. So I appreciate that. And I also appreciate the honor of being the audio for the announcement of Axiom BTC, the capital in the 21st century. Because I think this is a big deal. I think that as simple as the concept is, I think this is the purpose, the whole reason we are here. So definitely check them out. Definitely share this piece around, because I think we as Bitcoiners, who else is going to do this? You know, like, this is how we need to move forward. And while you're at it, actually listen to Green Eggs and Ham and Only the Strong Survive, because they are equally excellent pieces, and they will, if you did not understand a couple of the references or things that I was talking about in The Guy's Take, that is probably where you will find most of those answers, especially in regards to crypto. So a thank you as well to CoinKite for making the Cold Card hardware wallet and for supporting this show and bringing Bitcoin Audible to you guys, as well as the Fold Card for sats back on everything. Even if you're buying a Cold Card and you want to get 9% off, well, you can get another 1% plus a bunch of spins sats back just by buying it with the Fold Card. Links to do all of that, get your 9% off, and also to get the Fold Card and get 50,000 sats for free, it's right there in the description. It's literally, like, when you open up your app and you see the show that you're listening to, it, I just, like, scroll down just a little bit. It's literally right there. And I will catch you guys on the next episode. When you subscribe, you'll be pinged, because there'll be another episode coming very, very soon. Because that's what we do here. We read about Bitcoin and we fix the world. Also, there's a great video that I have. I'm almost finished up with it. On free unlimited transcription with some AI tools and how I do it. I've had a lot of people ask me about a bunch of my setup and my productivity tools and tricks and things that I've been doing, because I am very, very serious and I take a very, very long time setting up my workflows, and AI has become a critical part of so much of it. And so I'm trying to dig into all of that stuff, and I cannot believe what you can do with a lot of these tools now that people just don't know about. So do not forget to check out the YouTube channel. And I will be posting on Rumble as well as a backup, because I'm sure I will say something at some point that gets me banned from YouTube. So check both of those out and subscribe over there, because there will be content that doesn't really work with audio. Therefore, it will be video only. With that, thank you guys so much for listening, and I will catch you on the next episode of Bitcoin Audible or AI Unchained. More to come on so many different fronts, and I'll catch you then. Until then, everybody, take it easy, guys. Growth for the sake of growth is the ideology of the cancer cell. Edward Abbey.